Hello and welcome to the Genetics of Blood Sugar Balance. I'm Dr. Rita Marie Moscalzo, and I'm excited to share this cutting-edge science information that can be very helpful in you working with people who are maybe not quite getting the results that you're expecting when you're putting them on a blood sugar balancing program. So the genetics is a relatively new science. It started back in the 1990s when they started the Genome Project. We've mapped out lots and lots of genes and lots of variations on those genes, and I'm going to share with you how you can look at those and how they're reported, and then what are the specific ones related to blood sugar balance. So before we get started, all the information that I'm sharing with you, and then thus you are sharing with your clients and patients, is considered to be education. It's certainly not medical advice, and always if they're under the care of a doctor, or they're on medication, you make sure that they check in. The stuff that we do is profound and can make changes relatively rapidly, and so you want to make sure that they're being covered by that person or the other person on the other end. The beauty of working with genetic SNPs is that it allows us to eat more easily, do our root care, cause health care, versus just throwing darts in the dark. Sometimes people are just, they're doing all the right things and you just can't figure it out. And it may be a specific genetic marker that requires that they need more or less of a particular nutrient, or have to be more or less, well, more stringent on their dietary and movement restrictions. So we want to get away from the Band-Aid care and the throw the dart in the dark and hopefully you'll get the right solution. And what happens with the genetic knowledge, understanding their genetics can help you to identify it. We'll go through the process for it. And I want to let you know that by no means is genetics the first thing you start to look at, because you still have to work the foundations, all the stuff that you've been learning and putting into practice in the insulin resistance program. So we're about true health care, root cause health care. And yeah, the genetics get blamed a lot of the times. Like, oh, I'm just genetically, everybody in my family's fat, or everybody in my family has cravings, and everybody in my family gets diabetes. And the truth of the matter is, yes, there are lots of genetic markers, and there are a lot of epigenetic modifications that we as holistic health practitioners, as health coaches, as health advocates can help our clients and patients with. So we're going to be looking at genetic testing, the nutrigenomics, and the blood sugar balance. How do they all fit together? What is nutrigenomics and how does it affect blood sugar balance? And how can you actually get your clients tested and get yourself tested if you haven't already done that? So I want to take a little step backwards and just review so that we're all on the same page in terms of terminology. So SNPs. If you've heard the term SNPs before, then this is a review. If you haven't heard the term SNPs before, then this is something you need to understand in going through this presentation, because I'm going to be talking a lot about SNPs. SNPs is the little shortcut word for single nucleotide polymorphisms. So what are these polymorphisms? You might also hear them called polymorphisms for short, but the reason that they're called single nucleotide will become apparent in a moment. You have a picture here of a DNA molecule, and it's kind of like the close-up of a particular series of nucleotides. Nucleotides are basically what make up the DNA. In the DNA, we have 3 billion base pairs, 3 billion. And a base pair is a combination of 2 strands, the strands of DNA, and the 2 bases come together, and they're supposed to be the same for the most part. Not necessarily, but they're supposed to be the same. So if it's an A, the double strand should be an A and an A, or a C and a C. And the A, C, T, G stand for the nucleotides, cytosine, thymine, adenine, and guanine. Okay, and they are all the nucleotide bases that can be swapped out. So a single nucleotide polymorphism means a shift, a change in one of those places. So maybe it's supposed to be an A You might see it as a C, you might see it as a G, you might see it as a T. So it can be a different one in different places. Where, so you see all the others, CTA, GTA, CTA, GTA, all four of them are exactly the same, but there's this one spot where they could be different. And that's the SNP, that's the single nucleotide polymorphisms. So far they've measured, they've seen 110 million SNPs in the human genome. 10 million. Right? We don't know all about those. We just know that there are 10 million. We've identified quite a number of them and made correlations to particular health issues, or looked at what they code for in terms of enzymes and pathways in the body, so you could see what kind of variations there might be if that particular SNP occurs and that gene does not code properly for the protein that it's supposed to code for. Protein could be a structural protein. It could be an enzyme protein. And many of the ones we're going to talk about today are enzymatic proteins that these SNPs are coding for. Most lead to no observable differences as far as we can tell. Some lead to normal variations, like blue eyes might be BB, but brown eyes might be BRB. You know, it's different. And I'm just saying that's the gene thing. It may be a specific nucleotide, and I don't know what those are in particular, but like eye color, hair color, curly versus not curly, those are normal variations in the population. So these SNPs are not considered defects. So I always like to shy away from using the term genetic defects or genetic mutations. I like to use the term variations. And then others contribute to disease and nutrient imbalances, and we're going to share a bunch of those today. So let's take a look at what nutrigenomics are. What do we mean by nutrigenomics? It's a term that's relatively new, like I said, since the 1990s, and it's basically the study of how food and food constituents affect gene expression. Some of them will enhance the expression of a good gene, and improve its function. Some of them damage and cause variations in the expression. So we'll be looking at epigenetics to see how we can use foods to modify genes. The influence of genetic variation on nutrition. So to people with a different gene expression at a different spot in the DNA might absorb vitamin A differently, vitamin D differently, vitamin B12. Some may be very efficient and some may be 70% impaired. So it's the influence of that genetic variation on nutrition and the way that we then adapt them and help people to adapt their nutrition to that variation. In other words, to eat more vitamin A containing foods, more vitamin B12, supplement with vitamin A, supplement with D, whatever that polymorphism is. And we're going to look at some of those nutrient ones as they relate to blood sugar. There's a lot of them I haven't even looked up. A lot of them haven't even been I haven't looked up because there's nowhere to look them up, and it's a very time-consuming process, and I've tried to just like narrow this down so that you don't have to do the dozens of hours of research that I've done to get this material together. The correlation between single nucleotide polymorphisms, SNPs, and the nutrients absorption, metabolism, elimination, or biological effects. And the different SNPs will affect things differently. We may not be able to eliminate. So, for example, in some of the neurotransmitter-related SNPs, the body can't eliminate the used-up metabolites of neurotransmitters, and people get agitated. And in, say, an estrogen metabolism, same way. Some of the SNPs make it so that the body can't detoxify certain toxins in the environment as adequately as they would if they didn't have that SNP. So there's a lot of different ways that the SNPs make their appearance in your client's health. It provides a rational means to optimize nutrition with respect to genotype. But as I said at the start, we don't start with genes. We don't start with genes. We kind of end with genes, or we intersperse with genes when we're thinking, this isn't kind of going the way I think it should. Or we learn their genes as we're creating a program for them. So we know, yeah, this person might really need some extra vitamin A-rich foods or B-rich foods. But it doesn't take the place of the proper foundations, the proper diet. We can't just go in and say they have this gene, so they take this nutrient. You can really have to look at balancing. We'll come back to that. So what's epigenetics? Think about epigenetics as this meta layer that's over the genes. And the modifications that we make to that layer don't affect the DNA itself, but it alters the way those genes get expressed. Your DNA is your DNA. Yes, DNA can get damaged over the course of your life. And we have a lot of those things in the environment, you know, nuclear explosions and various and sundry carcinogenic compounds that have been noted as mutagens. So we can get mutations in our DNA, but we can't actually change the overall expression of those initial nucleotides. So the nucleotides are there. So when you do a genetic test with someone, it's a test you do once, as opposed to when you do a blood test or a stool test or an organic acid test or any of a number of functional tests. You do them over and over to see how the person's changing. The genes don't change. And also these don't necessarily show if the gene has been damaged. So stem cells get their organ-specific functions turned on through epigenetic processes. So this is an interesting way to look at it, but every single cell in your body has the same DNA. So my eye cells have coding for the proteins that make up the liver. My liver has proteins that make up eyes. But here we are. We have very individual body parts. Most of us don't have eyeballs growing out of our forehead or out of our livers, even though we could. And that could be a genetic alteration, an epigenetic alteration that could shift that. We haven't seen that, but we have seen mutations in some of the animals that are in polluted waters where they have extra limbs or extra body parts and no body parts and people born with, you know, extra limbs and not. So there could be epigenetic modification to the point where that the stem cells get confused and then we start to see organ-specific stuff for the eyes growing in the liver, right? We actually do see certain diseases where we get tumors like dermatologic type tumors in places like the ovary. Don't know if that's related to this particular process, but that just came to my mind. So epigenetics are at work all the time. And a change in the gene expression can result from environmental factors that just go beyond the tipping point. So it's like a little bit of damage, and it goes beyond, and we can cause cancer and tumor suppression genes to get turned off, and then the cancers and the tumors grow out of control. So it's really important to address diet and lifestyle to influence the epigenetic expression. And I've got a kind of a complicated chart, but it just basically shows you all the different factors that play in to the expression of the genes. So when you get someone tested or you get yourself tested and it says, oh, you have this gene that puts you at risk of Alzheimer's disease, it doesn't mean you're going to get Alzheimer's disease. But it does mean that in the right circumstances or the wrong circumstances, actually in unhealthy situations that make that gene express, that you have a much higher risk of getting Alzheimer's and you need to be a little bit more pristine. I believe that these epigenetic factors have a lot to do with the expression, but also why certain people have really bad diet, bad environment, and they get sick and die young versus other people, same thing, same environmental and food stressors, and they live long lives. It's because of the genes. So the one person didn't have the genes to turn on. The other one did have some SNPs that got turned on by the environment. So we look at, we have up at the top, we have the diet and all the factors we talk about all the time that affect us. It goes into epigenetic modification. We've got our genomes, our DNA, and the expression of those genes develop and determine whether we're going to get into a point of pathology and disease. Very important concepts. So you may have also heard, and again, we're just still doing some definitions before I get into the specific genes related to blood sugar, But methylation is actually a process of creating these methyl groups. They're actually just tags that affect the expression of a gene. They can turn on or off the expression of the gene. The methylation, the methyl groups, also have a lot to do with repairing DNA. And then you'll hear about this process called the methionine cycle or the SAMe cycle. It's known as the methylation cycle, and it's a picture of this particular set of compounds that go cycling around because it affects DNA methylation. And we can look a little bit more about that in a bit. That's what the good old methyl group looks like. And methylation is important in blood sugar balance, and we'll see which genes are involved with that. So the methyl group is just a simple group. A carbon and three hydrogens. And it basically becomes hot potato in a game of hot potato that is a methylation cycle. And the methyl group just gets passed from one to another to another to another. And some of the most common methyl donors are listed on this page. SAMe, S-adenosylmethionine, folate, which is vitamin B9. And notice I say folate, not folic acid, because folic acid is the synthetic version that actually impairs the functioning of this, the natural version, the methylated version. Vitamin B12, trimethylglycine, dimethylglycine, and DMAE, dimethylamine, ethanolamine. So betaine is actually the other name for TMG, trimethylglycine. Betaine is part of or compounds with the hydrochloric acid for stomach acid. So all of these things have effects on everything going on in the body. So methylation functions. It's the function of methylation is to turn on and off genes and synthesize the DNA, to process toxins. In the liver, there's stage 1 and stage 2 detoxification, or phase 1 and phase 2, apparently, is what it's called. And in phase 1 is a very simple process of just basically adding water to the toxins. And then in phase 2, we have a lot of different processes. We have about 6 or 7 different processes, and one of them is methylation. And each of those different processes in phase 2 handles different chemicals in the environment. Well, the methylation one handles metabolizing used up neurotransmitters, processing estrogens and helping us to eliminate estrogens in a safe way, building the immune system, producing energy, CoQ10, carnitine, etc., producing myelin sheaths, and then building and maintaining cell membranes. And there's phosphatidylcholine. And we're going to see as we go through these specific SNPs for blood sugar how important cell membranes are for insulin resistance and blood sugar balance, right? Because we have the cell membranes that house the receptors. And so damage to those can create a problem with resistance and with sensitivity. So let's look at genetic testing. That was an overview of you know, where it's come and some of the definitions. So there's ways to get testing done. These are some of the genomic testing services I've given you as a resource. You've probably heard of most of these already. I mostly have people use 23andMe because it gives the most extensive report. I understand there's another one that's soon to be unveiled that will give similar to that. PathwayFit does a very small number, like 35 or 40 genes. Holistic Health International by Dr. Amy Yasko does, I think, about 35 of them and just the methylation genes. So you won't see any of the blood sugar genes there. You'll see a couple of them that will predispose to blood sugar problems that we'll talk about in a bit, but you won't see all of them. Genova Diagnostic has a whole bunch of different panels. Pricey. Each of the panels is $300 to $500. And if you were to put all of them together, you still wouldn't have as much as 23andMe gives you, and the price would cost you several thousand to do it all through Genova. So we're mostly using 23andMe and then processing their raw data. And then SpectraCell, which only does MTHFR, and I understand that Great Plains might have added a genetic test that I haven't seen up close and personal yet. There are interpretation services. So you basically are going to take the raw data. I'll show you how to do that in a moment. You're going to take raw data, which is just this information about these SNPs. Every single gene is mapped out. And it's basically you have to run that data through a report unless you're really brilliant and can interpret it yourself based on the raw data. I can't do it. I use these reports. So there's geneticgenie.org. It's free, but they ask for like a $5 donation for running the report. That gives you methylation genes, and it gives you detox genes, but it doesn't give you the specific genes that we're going to be looking at today in regards to blood sugar. MTHFRsupport.com runs a report on many, 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 many hundreds of genes, and there's a 49-page report, and each page has listed, I don't know, probably 25 of them. So do the math. There's a lot of them there. They don't do a great job of explaining them. They do for some. They have pop-ups and they have little videos that you can do when you view the report on your site. But it's a good, I always run it on people so I have an easy reference to look up specific genes as opposed to having to go into 23andMe and look at the raw data directly. Metabolic Healing has come up with a recent set. Nice. It has sections for each of the types, like brain health and gut health, but they don't have a blood sugar part. Stratagene is mostly methylation with a few extras. LiveWello and Prometheus are very comprehensive, but I have never really liked their reporting. You may like it. It just may be a matter of personal preference for me, but I've never really liked the reporting style. So those are just references. You can run them. I recommend that you play with them and like run your own and run it on yourself and then use the information I'm going to show you here to see, do you have an insulin resistance issue going on based on your genes? I've gone through and looked at most of these on myself, and I have actually most of them. So here's the thing. When you go to 23andMe and you run the test, they now have this two services, the Ancestry service and the Health and Ancestry service combined. For a while, they just had this one way you did it. You just did it and you got the health and you got the ancestry. But then the FDA shut them down a few years ago because some of the stuff they were saying, they didn't feel like they had done, you know, double blind studies, so they weren't sure it was so accurate. But you could still, during that period of time, get the raw data. Once they got all the FDA approvals, they probably had to pay for it somehow, and they raised the price. But it's my understanding that when you get the test done, even if you just go for the ancestry service, you're still going to have the full raw data. What you're not going to have is access to the site where their health data is reported. I personally don't care for their health data. It might be good for other people, but it's not geeky enough for me. It doesn't like list it by specific genes that I know about, and there's not an easy way in the health data reports to look up a specific SNP if you wanted to find out if this person had it. You'd have to go to the raw data. This is my understanding in speaking to someone who is working on a complete genomics reporting on all the blood sugar diabetes related stuff in software, and they said they have been downloading it and getting everything. So that's a good thing to know. It probably makes sense because it would probably be very expensive for them to retool to only do part of the DNA, and it wouldn't pay. So they're basically charging an extra $100 for the reporting. My understanding, I haven't verified it 100% yet, but here's the thing. If you want to find it out, you run yours on the Ancestry service. You get it back. You look at the SNPs, you look up some of these SNPs in there, MTHFR, MTRR, et cetera, and if you find that it's pretty complete, then you know that that's there, that it's right. So, and if it's not, then you pay the extra $100 to upgrade and you get the full report anyway. But I don't think, because they only charge you $100 to run it, to get the full, and they just unlock it for you, it says to me that you don't have to send in another sample. They don't have to run it for another 4 weeks. So that makes sense to me. This is what the list looks like, and this is where I confirmed on their site. It's hard to read, but you can go to the 23andMe site and look at comparing the ancestry and the health. And what it says is, somewhere in there, it says raw data. Both of them have it. So my guess is it's the same. So once you get in, somebody has their test run, you have your test run, your client has your test run, you go in and at the top, there's a menu thing that says tools. You click on that, and that gives you access to your raw data. And what happens when you come into tools, you see this, and that the one down here says raw data. You click that, and then you get raw data opt-in. They want to make sure that you know that, you know, this is sensitive information, et cetera, et cetera. You have to click that you understand, and then they show you raw data. Now, you can do searches, or they'll just show you all the chromosomes. You can click on one of these chromosomes to see all the different SNPs and genes on there. You can also search. You can put up here, I think I put up here, MTHFR, and the top for search, and you can look for it. So as you learn these SNPs that I'm going to share with you, and you'll have all the charts, then what you can do is just find, oh, I want to find out if I have the IGF-1 gene. So you type in IGF-1, and it will find it. It'll tell you what gene it's on. And then the other way to look things up is by RSID. And RSID, you would find out by going to Google or going to something called Snipedia, S-N-P-E-D-I-A, Snipedia. I have a reference link for it later in the presentation. And you would type in an RSID. And RSID is the number that's been associated with the particular genes. And every SNP has a specific RSID associated with it. If you just type in the gene, like we did here, you're going to see all these different ones and the different RSIDs, and you may not know which one's related. Like we talk about MTHFR A677T. Well, they don't list it that way in the genetic raw data here. They list it by RSID, so it makes it harder for you to do this, and that's why so many of those cool interpretation reports have come out. So you'd look up, you'd write in Google, you'd say MTHFR 677T, you'd know, okay, that's the RSID, then you'd look it up to see if that person had it. The other problem with looking just at the raw data is that it doesn't tell you what the risk allele is or the wild type. So let me explain what those terms mean. So if I look at this particular like MTHFR, this very top one, it says it's going to be either C or T. But it doesn't tell me which is the norm, which is the common, they call the common the wild type, or which is the risk allele, which of those, and alleles are just basically another nutrigenomics terminology or genetics terminology. So which is the risk one? Is it C or is it T? You don't know. You know that if yours actually comes out, let's look at the second one because that one isn't there. Sometimes you'll see ones that just don't come out. So this one says A or G. This person has AA. So we don't know if they are normal or they are homozygous, meaning that they have a double SNP, which puts them at higher risk. If we had A right here, right, it says A or G, you're an AG. That means that one parent gave you an A, the other parent gave you a G. But again, we don't know which one is good and which one's bad, but this is easier because we know we're what's called heterozygous. We have one of each. So that's why it's really hard reading the raw data, and it's much easier. I'll show you some of the reporting that they do on the other sites. Much easier to read the others. So let's just look at blood sugar balance SNPs. And when you get, I would highly recommend that you run something like the MTHFR support. It doesn't show everything. There's going to be some that you don't find there. So you may have to look in the raw data. But if you can find most of them and only have to look in the raw data a little bit, then it's going to be much better. They try to do most of the things that have clinical significance, but they don't always catch everything. So let's look at SNPs and blood sugar balance. Again, SNPs are the mutations, right? The little genetic mutations. This is a list that increased the risk for elevated blood sugar. I don't have a lot of details on all of these, but I just have them. They just are listed as increased risk for blood sugar, elevated blood sugar. You can look in more detail, and I'm going to show you a couple of references there. But what I did was I picked out a group that I chose to give you more details on because they're more prominent and more common and the information is more readily available. So this first one that we're looking at is MC4R. It's pancreatic neuronal melanocortin 4, melanocortin MC4. And it's basically, it codes for an enzyme, and it's significantly higher blood sugars are associated with obesity when the person has this. This is related to a leptin-regulated melanocortin system that modulates energy homeostasis. It modulates that and the hypothalamic control of insulin secretion. So it's basically related to leptin, and leptin will trigger that the insulin regulation. Now, we don't do anymore that we're picking up insulin sensitivity in the hypothalamus. The pancreatic neuronal melanocortin 4 receptor modulates serum insulin levels independent of the leptin receptor. Okay, independent of the leptin receptor. And there's a PubMed publication. So for each of those, I've given you some details where you can go into it. It's very complicated, all the science behind these. They're enzymes and pathways that we don't normally study unless we're into that biochemistry and testing type stuff. But this one is an important one, and we see significantly higher blood sugars associated with obesity in people with this SNP. The next one you might have heard of, insulin-like growth factor 1 receptor. So this particular SNP is associated with problems with the insulin-like growth factor 1 receptor. What is insulin-like growth factor? It's a polypeptide protein hormone, and it's similar in molecular structure to insulin. It's in a category of receptors called tyrosine kinase, which means that they signal by causing the addition of a phosphate molecule on a particular tyrosine module, or on particular multiple tyrosines. So tyrosine's an amino acid, and this particular kinase will add phosphates onto that, and that's how those receptors are triggered. Also, though, the IGF-1R binds to the insulin receptors, and that can cause insulin resistance in the target tissues where they're binding. And that was just a little picture of it. It's hard to see, but it shows you what it's like, the channel that's opening things up. Okay, next one. IRS1, insulin receptor substrate 1. It codes for what's called a signaling adapter protein, and it has a role in transmitting the signals from insulin and insulin-like growth factor to the cells. So basically, it's like, okay, get stuff into the cells. How do we get stuff into the cells? So that receptor, the insulin receptor sitting on the cell, if somebody has a problem with the insulin receptor, it's going to alter the way that they process insulin. So it can mediate the control of various cellular processes by insulin. And it's associated with the susceptibility to type 2 diabetes and insulin resistance, because it's the receptor itself. So we can have a problem with the receptor itself. Again, I've given you a link. So this particular gene, the MTRRA66G, is part of the methylation process. It codes for an enzyme called methyl tetrahydrofolate homocysteine methyltransferase reductase. This is what this particular gene codes. This helps recycle the B12 when we're going through the methylation pathway. Converts homocysteine to methionine, and homocysteine is a chemical that builds up when we don't have enough methylation going on in the cycle, and we don't have enough B12 being methylated, or we don't have enough DMG, TMG. We end up with buildup of homocysteine because the homocysteine cannot get converted to methionine. When we have elevated levels of homocysteine, it damages the endothelial lining in the blood vessels. It also damages the delicate membranes in the brain and increases the risk of obesity. The association with metabolic syndrome and insulin resistance for this particular gene, SNP, is mostly in combination with somebody who also has an MTHFR, C677T. They did some studies that showed that if it was just the MTRRA66G, that they didn't seem to have an increased association with metabolic syndrome, but it was that synergy of how they worked together. And because MTHFR is also related to the methylation cycle. So here's another one, the MTHFR 6C677T. You've probably heard of this one when people say, I have an MTHFR problem. This is the one that's most studied. Of all these hundreds of thousands of SNPs, MTHFR has become the most popular. Methylene tetrahydrofolate reductase. It's super important because without it, we gum up the methylation cycle. Helps convert homocysteine to methionine, just like the other one. And then it's converted to SAMe, which SAMe then is like the master methyl donor. And it can go in and actually get in and do the DNA repair and helps with red blood cell synthesis and other things like that. This particular SNP can lead to high homocysteine, which we mentioned before, damages blood vessel linings, damages brain cells, and can trigger obesity. The insulin signaling mechanisms are impaired, or were impaired in a study when they took cultured cells and injected them with homocysteine thiolactone. So they injected these cells that were cultured in a dish with the homocysteine and measured the insulin signaling mechanism. This, again, holds an increased risk of obesity and association with metabolic syndrome and insulin resistance. There is controversy in the literature, but there are plenty of studies that support that MTHFR C677T has a big effect on metabolic syndrome risk and insulin resistance risk. So if you're working with somebody and you seem to be doing a lot of things, you're going to be able to go back to looking at the genes and saying, oh, they have this. Maybe we can support them by improving their green leafy vegetable consumption, by improving their methylfolate consumption. When someone has an MTHFR C677T, and this is just an extra tidbit that I threw in there, is COMT. If they also have this COMTV158M SNP, they can lead to mood swings. And the way that that's related to insulin resistance is we know that stress is one of the five elements that lead to problems with insulin resistance. So if you have somebody who you just can't calm down, you can't slow them down because they're just little stress bunnies, it could be related to this. And addressing these SNPs by appropriate diet, lifestyle, supplementation can be life-saving. Here's one. It's called the FTO. And when I first saw this, I'm like, is that really what they call it? There was one place that called it the FATSO gene. And I'm like, oh, that's not nice. But this one is actually called fat mass and obesity associated protein, also called alpha ketoglutarate dependent deoxygenase FTO. It's a very specific protein that affects the feeling of satiation after eating. So this is a thing that leads people to what? Overeat sugar, which what does that do to their insulin issues and their blood sugar issues? It makes it way worse. So the increases in the hypothalamic expression of FTO were associated with the regulation of energy intake, but not feeding rewards. So like when this was a problem, when the FTO was not working properly, that people, they had the energy. They had energy to move and do stuff, but they didn't get that feeling go away. You know, you may eat and, you know, you feel like, okay, I can handle things. I needed to eat to get some fuel, but you still feel that hunger, which isn't really hunger, actually. It's more appetite. Like, I just need more. It's because that signal wasn't turned off, and it could be this gene. So it's a good one to look up for those people who say, I just keep eating and eating and eating, even though I'm, you know, not hungry, I still feel unsatiated. And it's definitely associated with obesity, and it definitely reduces insulin sensitivity. The leptin receptor gene. The leptin receptor gene is associated with increased snacking behavior. Leptin is a hormone that's secreted by fat cells when they get full and they go, okay, I'm done. Don't feed me anymore. The problem is over time, and when people just override that and they keep eating beyond that, whatever it is, emotional eating, whatever, and they start to get obese and have a lot of extra fat, they're producing a lot of leptin. And the receptors for leptin in both the brain, the hypothalamus, and the pancreas get turned off. And they get resistant, just like we get insulin resistance. And we talked a lot about this in one of our modules in IRSPT. If you haven't gotten there yet, you will. You'll learn all about leptin and the interaction with insulin. And so When the leptin is not being read, then the signal to turn off and lower the insulin down to baseline doesn't get read either. So we're finding that this particular SNP, this particular polymorphism of the LEPR gene, Q223R, is associated with insulin resistance. Here's one, SLC2A2. It stands for solute carrier family 2 member 2. You know, some of these scientific names are just beyond you. Some of them make sense, right? LEPR, leptin receptor. Got it. Yay. It codes for a sugar transporter receptor called GLUT2. GLUT2, we're going to talk about in a moment, has to do with the receptors that help the insulin get into the pancreas and also into the liver. Now, there's a number of GLUT receptors, GLUT, for the cells. These particular GLUT2 has an effect on the pancreas and also on the liver. What that means is that when we try to store the extra sugar and get them into the liver cells to be converted to glycogen, it won't take because that GLUT2 receptor is not working properly. When the pancreas is trying to read the blood and allow the insulin to get in and say, okay, how much sugar do we have out there? That doesn't happen. So the pancreas isn't able to regulate as well, and the liver is not able to create glycogen and store the extra sugar. And that could lead to elevated blood sugars. So there's a particular mutation called F2, and there I go, mutation, it should have said SNPed, SNP F295Y, that induced beta cell differentiation even in the absence of glucose. So it was actually impacting the beta cells even when somebody wasn't eating. So if you ever have those folks that they're doing a lot of things right, but they're still having problems with having the cravings because the sugar mechanisms are faulty, it may be this gene. It's also known as the sweet tooth gene. There was one particular study in 2008 where they took people, they checked people with the SLCA2 and compared them to normal, and they actually ate more sugar. And they hypothesized that this SNP causes the brain to be less sensitive to blood glucose levels, then they may need to eat more sugar to feel full. SNPs related to the glucose sugar, to blood sugar glucose transported to. We talked briefly about that. It's one of a group of cell receptors that would allow for the transport of glucose into cells. This is what we're trying to do when we're trying to restore insulin sensitivity, is allow all these different mechanisms to start working again. The GLUT2 in particular is found in hepatocytes, which are liver cells, pancreatic beta cells, which make the insulin, and then the intestinal mucosa and kidney. So it's affecting some really important places in the body. It has a role in blood glucose homeostasis by altering the rate of glucose uptake, especially into the liver cells, which would create a problem with glycogen storage. We don't store enough glycogen, and we're not able to take the sugar and convert it to glycogen. SNPs related to blood sugar, again, ABCC8, ATP binding cassette transporter, subfamily C, member 8. So that's why we call it ABCC8. It codes for a particular receptor, a sulfonylurea receptor, which helps regulate insulin. It's involved in transporting various modules, not just insulin, across cell membranes. When this is off, this particular SNP can result in a failure of insulin release from the beta cells, and that can lead to a type 1 diabetes, okay? So it's not allowing the insulin to actually get released. This is the opposite. So this is more related to type 1 diabetes, but I threw a few things in, and I have another chart later that I give you a place where you can look if you're interested in looking at type 1 diabetes. Since this program is about insulin resistance, we're more focused on the ones that affect type 2 diabetes and insulin resistance and metabolic syndrome. So this is a particular thing that's found in a condition that happens in infancy. And we see people who have hyperinsulinemic hypoglycemia as babies. And it's unregulated high insulin secretion. So as babies, you know, there's definitely that genetic tendency. And this is what we would see, and that could lead to those babies getting type 1 diabetes real early on. A lot of this stuff is, you know, really infancy stuff, and I don't know specific ways you would approach it, but if you had somebody, you'd start to do your basics, of course, and see what kind of other research. I was telling someone recently that every person that I can't help with what I know is a learning opportunity that I go and I research further. So you're always going to come upon folks that are difficult. You're doing what seems to be the right things, but they're not getting better. And that's an opportunity for you to be learning and growing. So we have a glucagon receptor, GCGR, glucagon receptor. It's a G protein coupled receptor for glucagon. So G protein is a particular type of protein. It plays a central role in the regulation of blood glucose levels and glucose homeostasis by regulating the rate of hepatic glucose production by promoting glycogen hydrolysis and gluconeogenesis. So if this is in particular a gene, a SNP that somebody has, they're not going to be able, if they're going to have differences, they can have an upregulation or a downregulation of their ability to make, turn glycogen into glucose. So here's the thing. It has an important role in mediating the response to fasting, right? So if somebody has a problem, a defect in their ability to actually mobilize the glycogen, they're very slow at doing the mobilization of the glycogen to turn it into glucose, that person's not going to do really well with fasting. So again, a lot of these are associated with type 2 diabetes. PPARG, peroxisome proliferator activated receptor gamma. What the heck? It's a regulator of adipocyte differentiation, so fat cell differentiation. So the PPAR gamma that's in the adipose tissue is an essential mediator for the maintenance of whole body insulin sensitivity. It protects the non-fatty tissue against lipid overload and maintains normal organ function. So the SNPs that we've seen here are associated with decreased insulin sensitivity and the weight gain with diabetes. Here's one called LIPC, lipase C hepatic type. This encodes for the lipoproteins, the LDLs, the HDLs, the VLDLs, and maintains a balance, helps to raise the LDLs and keep it down. So if there's a problem here, it's going to affect those levels, those ratios. And a lot of studies showed the effects that it affects insulin sensitivity in response to exercise. So if somebody exercises, you're expecting that they're going to get improved insulin sensitivity, right? And if they're not, it could be a SNP in this particular gene. I'm thinking it might also have a relationship to how some people will do bursts and they get phenomenal drops in their glucose, and other people have their glucose go up after they do bursts. Might be a genetic component. Here's another one, TCF7L2. And by the way, I don't expect anybody to memorize these, but having these charts available and having these resources available, and when something comes up for yourself or someone you're working with, you're going to learn a whole lot more about these. So this is a transcription factor, transcription of several genes. Okay, so that's actually the way that the genetics are expressing. It's a member of something called the WNT signaling pathway, which means that they pass signals into a cell through the cell surface receptors. It's basically cell surface receptors and the signaling to get stuff from the outside and this message to get into it. Well, what do we know about insulin and glucose, right? Glucose requires the insulin to escort it into the cells. So this SNPs in this area will affect insulin secretion and blood glucose production. Well, too much of it stimulates insulin secretion. And so some genes will cause a lowering of the specific pathway that they regulate. Others cause what's called an upregulation. So if you've got too much activity of this gene, it actually stimulates more insulin secretion, which isn't good news for someone who's a type 2 diabetic or somebody who's insulin resistant. So this is going to actually make insulin resistance worse. Might actually be something that that particular defect is going to protect that person from a type 1 diabetes because they're going to get plenty of insulin. So here's one, ADIPOQ, adiponectin. Now the full name of this, it controls adiponectin, but the full name of this gene is adiponectin C1Q and collagen domain containing. Yes, it does end with containing. Very confusing. It's expressed by adipose tissue alone. That's the only place where this particular gene will express itself. The SNPs associated with it cause adiponectin deficiency. So what's adiponectin? If you've been in our CMDS class, you know we talked about adiponectin in detail in the section on hormones of digestion, hormones of appetite. And adiponectin is one of those potent ones in there. It's one of the strong indicators in the appetite. And it stimulates the uptake of glucose by the muscle, inhibits glucose production by the liver, and decreases blood glucose levels and decreases appetite. Well, those sound like all wonderful things for someone who's struggling to get their blood sugar balance going, right? Stimulate the glucose uptake by the muscle, inhibits the glucose production, decreases blood glucose levels, and decreases appetite, so they're not overstuffing themselves either. Adiponectin provides a link between the visceral fat accumulation and insulin resistance, and they find that people with this gene tend to have a higher accumulation of that fat, the adipose, around the organs, which is the visceral fat. So as a result, somebody with this particular SNP is going to have a higher risk for obesity and type 2 diabetes. This one's a cool one, AKT2. The name has nothing to do with what it is. That name, AKT2, said something to do with a particular strain of rats the original researcher was doing. He called them a particular thing, and the name stuck for the gene that he came up with. So that it's really serine threonine protein kinase. So serine and threonine are both amino acids. The insulin receptor coupled phosphatidyl inositol 3 kinase mediating signaling. This is required for glucose transport, transport of glucose into the cells. So this affects the way that the insulin moves the sugars into the cells. And it's related to severe insulin resistance and diabetes. So if somebody has this SNP, they're going to be struggling with the insulin resistance. And what does that mean? Does that mean you just say, well, sorry, you know, you have to live with it? No, it means you're going to have them be more careful. Looking at the folks, and I don't remember if this is one that I have or not, but when you look at folks who, you know, can eat 4 bananas and 3 dates and not have their blood sugar go up, and somebody else who takes, you know, a tiny little dribble of any of that and their blood sugar does go up, are related to the genes. And so it just means that people who have the genetics are going to have to be more careful. What I find is that people are always saying, well, I did that all right. What's going on? Well, yeah, you got to look at the stress and the sleep and all the rest of it. But sometimes they're doing it and they just have to be more careful. And I'd like to be able to promise people that do a 30-day metabolic reset and you'll be able to slowly add the foods back in, the good foods, not the junk foods, back in. But the truth of the matter is some people are just going to have to be really careful of their life. When that you look at some of the reports and some of the statistics and studies on insulin resistance, it's that 25% of the population are going to be fine no matter what they do. You know, they're maybe not healthy in all the ways, but they're not going to have a blood sugar problem no matter how much sugar they eat or junk they eat. And then another 25% are going to be super duper careful. And that's where I fall in because I've got a lot of these SNPs. You just have to be super duper careful. And then other people, it's like, well, they got into trouble because of their lifestyle. And then when they reverse their lifestyle, they get great results and they can maintain it with a very healthy whole foods diet that you don't have to be severe glycemically restricted. So these SNPs are going to give you ways to look at people and say, okay, I really hate to break this to you, but you're going to have to be more careful based on your genes. And those are the two particular genes that were studied, this particular SNPs that were studied, the R208K and the R467W. And there's articles, you can go into this. We don't have time to go into every single one of these in great detail, or we'd be here for 3 or 4 or 5 days.
So the next one we're going to look at, it's actually the last one that we're going to look at in this detail, is the Calpain 10. It's a family of calcium-dependent cysteine proteases, protease meaning a protein-digesting enzyme. This one has been found to be associated with risk of type 2 diabetes, especially in Mexican-Americans. There are a lot of studies on that. The information on molecular and physiologic mechanisms explaining the associations is limited, so I can't even tell you what the association is, but the association is definitely very high. And there's some studies here that you can look at. You can learn more about it. But as far as I like to look at mechanisms and why it does what it does, and there's not anything that I could find. So that's it for the specific details. I put together a little summary chart that has all of them in there, and it just has a little one-liner so that you can look up these things, and then you can go into more detail on them. And then if you want even more detail, you can click the links. And then here's some additional resources for the blood sugar-related SNPs. The first one is the ones that are associated with type 1 diabetes. So even though we're talking insulin resistance here, you may have people you're working with or family members or even yourself with type 1 diabetes and you want to know more. That's a link. This next one is a really good detail about the genes that are related to insulin resistance and type 2. And I'm going to show you a few of the charts that are on there. And there's certainly more things you can go through. Like I said, I had to pick and choose amongst the genes, and I found the ones that had the most research, but there's so many more. We could have done, you know, so many more and spent so much more time, but there's a limit to the amount of time we can do a call like this. So I'm giving you a good starting point. But, yeah, that dranamarie.com/go/SNP carb diet, whatever, that one's a good one, and I'll show you a couple of charts from there. There's some SNPs associated with insulin resistance. It's a really good article on the Medline, the National Institute of Medicine. There's some on the genetics of insulin resistance. These are just really good articles, very detailed articles, full-text articles, so you can really dig in and learn a whole lot more. And you're going to learn more when you need to. You're not going to just sit down and try to memorize all this stuff. But as you have clients or patients or yourself or family members that show up with these particular genes, you can look them up this way. Okay, so here's some of the pictures. These are really cool. In this article that I said, that the second reference that I gave you, they have these charts of the various ones. They show you actually the RSID, and then I don't know what this is, and then the reference is within that data. So there's 14, 15, 16. There's articles that you can read more about them. So it's quite complete, and it breaks it down by the mechanism. So insulin resistance, abdominal obesity, inflammation, and triglycerides, and then HDL cholesterol. So all of these are related, and I have the link at the bottom of there you can go further in detail on. But you got to also look at the nutrients, right? And I, like I said, I haven't seen much in the way of magnesium or chromium, but those would be good to look up to see if there's any, you know, research. I have not done the extensive exhaustive on all of that yet. But vitamin A, if somebody has a BCOM, they're really unable to efficiently convert beta-carotene to vitamin A, so they're going to need more vitamin A. We need vitamin A for membranes. We need it for the digestive tract, and we need it for proper glucose support. Vitamin B6, B vitamins in general are important. We've talked about that for insulin resistance. So there's one called NBPF3. Vitamin B12, we talked about two of them, the MTRR. Well, we talked briefly about MTR, but also the FUT2 all affect vitamin B12 status, and we know B12 is an important one. MTHFR is related to folate and vitamin B2. Vitamin C is associated with SLC23A1. Vitamin E with some kind of intergenic. It's an in-between. I'm not sure exactly how you would find that, but it increases vitamin E. So all of these are nutrient-related. There's a whole bunch related to vitamin D, and we know that vitamin D is super important for maintaining digestive balance, insulin resistance, thyroid balance, just about everything. So I wanted to make sure that you knew which those SNPs were. You got that list. And then for the vitamin D, the VDR is one of the ones you're going to see most. That's the vitamin D receptor SNP, and that can lead to low or low normal vitamin D. And people with this SNP can have problems with needing a lot more vitamin D than you think they should. So I don't want you to just go on the, okay, they're taking vitamin D, they're taking 3,000 IUs a day. They may be going years and years with a vitamin D deficiency because they have some SNPs, and 3,000 is a drop in the bucket for them. They need more. I had a guy who came up with the vitamin D test below 10. It was like 8. And so I said, look, I want you to take 20,000 for 3 months, get it retested, and then we'll see what we have to adjust it to. Guy was, you know, back in the day when I used to do just one-off calls. Now I don't see people unless they're willing to sign up for a package of calls because of this particular reason that he just never came back in until a year and a half later. He redoes all his labs. I didn't remember what his labs were before, so it took me forever to go through all these labs. And I go, he didn't do vitamin D. Why didn't you do vitamin D? And he says, oh, I guess the doctor didn't run that one. Oh, okay. So how much vitamin D are you taking now? He said 20,000, like you told me. I'm like, it had been a year and a half he'd taken 20,000. I was thinking, oh, my God, he's got all these calcium and everything else, metabolism problems, and he's too much vitamin D. What's going to happen here? And I said, you get that done immediately, and you tell me what the result was. After a year and a half of taking 20,000 a day, the guy's vitamin D was only at 60. So this is someone who needs massive doses of vitamin D as a result of the genetics. And we did eventually, he eventually on his own, he's very independent, so he does this stuff. And when he gets stuck, he comes and asks me questions. Action plan. So how do you do this? How do you put this into action? You get the 23andMe testing done. You download the raw data. Very easy to do. I have your slides. You can look back at them.
Look up the genes in the raw data on 23andMe site. Okay? If you want to. If you don't want to run the reports, or you spend a little extra money, like $30 for each of the reports, free for Genetic Genie, and you run the reports. I like Genetic Genie because it gives me a single sheet, very quick and easy. What's going on with methylation? What's going on with their detox pathways? And we know that detox pathway blockages are super important. I didn't even put that in here. I should add that chart, that slide. I have a slide on detox pathways because it's important, because we know that toxic buildup affects insulin receptors. So you look at those, and then you can look at the MTHFR support report, and they have a really nice, you know, 49-page printout, and they have some pathways you can look at. They just don't have a lot of explanation. Metabolic Healing and Stratagene have really nice report structure, so you learn more about it. Still not quite user-friendly for the end user, so it's still going to take you explaining to them. And then optionally, the LiveWell and Prometheus, like I said, I've run those. I don't really care for them all that much. A great thing to do, run a Stratagene on yourself. That gives you access to the Stratagene Facebook group. Lots of great activity there. Lots of great places to ask questions. And then always study with someone who's a few steps ahead. Those people in the NEPT program are a few steps ahead of most people because we've done so many case study calls going over genes. So those are good people. And study, you know, you can getting into NEPT and up from this program when you're done is to just talk to us about getting into the full program, because you get so much more than just the insulin resistance. So there's complex interrelationships. The stuff works together. The genes work together. You can't just say this person has MTHFR, so let's just give them methyl folate. This person has an MTR, just give them methyl B12. This person has a BCMO1, just give them vitamin A. You can't do the this for that. It's complicated. The raw data looks at over 900,000 SNPs. When you look at Genetic Genie and Yasco, it's about 30. The MTHFR support and LiveWello will report on about 300. The Stratagene and Metabolic Healing report on several dozen. This is in the infancy state. More and more reports are coming out, more and more places. It's getting competitive, but more and more practitioners are studying this. So you want to be on the leading edge. When I started doing this back in 2008, nobody was doing it. It was just alphabet soup, SNPs and MTHFR and RR, and they'd heard about some of that. But the way that it's grown over the last 8-9 years since I started doing this is dramatic, and it's going to keep growing. So you need to be on the leading edge. We have, within NEPT, we do have a ton of research and resources and me reading people's genes and giving you insights and then tons of case studies on it. And then we have a whole module on methylation. So we have, so far we've got recorded, oh man, not methylation, but genetics, nutrigenomics. We've probably got 25 to 30 hours worth of resources recorded that you have access to when you're in NEPT. So those of you who are in and you're new in, don't fret. You've got it coming. You need to have a holistic perspective, and I can't help, I just don't want you to lose sight of that. There's a small percentage of genes that we know that have a one-to-one cause and effect relationship. Cystic fibrosis is one, but most of it is a very complex process, and there's compensatory processes. And just because you have a sluggishness in one gene, another gene may make it up and you may be fine as long as you keep the diet lifestyle foundations working and you have the person's blood sugar balance and their gut function working and their low stress. So I like to think of it as the blind men and an elephant. If you set a bunch of blind men up against an elephant and each one gets a different part and you ask them to identify the structure that they have and they're not allowed to touch any other part, they're thinking, well, it's a tree because of the trunk. Oh, it's a snake. It's because of the tail. Maybe it's a wall because of the body. It's all different things that they're seeing it because they're seeing it from one perspective. And I don't want you to start looking at your clients from one perspective. Blood sugar balancing is super important and it leads into the other stuff. And when someone comes in with hot flashes, you can't treat them for hot flashes. You've got to be looking at the whole thing, and blood sugar is big and it's important. And the same thing with the genes. You can't just say they have this MTHFR, I'm just going to do something, they're going to get better. It's very misleading, and it's just propagating the this for that approach in medicine. So before you address those individual SNPs, you want to be looking at their foundational lifestyle and diet, the seven pillars. The seven pillars of clean, whole foods, antioxidant-rich diet, good sleep, low stress, good attitude, clean environment, movement, and actually fun. And they're listed at the bottom of this pyramid here. You need to remove all the folic acid because folic acid interferes with methylation and it blocks the receptors for methylfolate. Especially important if they have a SNP at MTHFR, but if they don't, you still want to avoid it. The gut healing and pathogen removal. They've got to have a clean gut. And we know that that affects their blood sugar. We know that the balancing blood sugar affects this whole thing. We want to address if they have mitochondrial dysfunction, if they have low energy, if they have low B vitamins. They're not getting enough protein in because they're not absorbing, because they have low stomach acid, and they're not getting the amino acids in to go through the Krebs cycle. You want to test their homocysteine levels to see if they have some of these imbalances. And we saw that high homocysteine levels can affect their blood sugar. B vitamin support, always helpful because most people are under stress. Adrenal support and adaptogens, thyroid support if needed. All of these need to be addressed before you jump in and try to address individual SNPs. So this is a cute little cartoon, the cavemen. The air is clean, our water's pure, we get plenty of exercise, everything we eat is organic and free range, yet nobody lives past 30. And it's not just about genes and diet and lifestyle. The environment has a lot to do with it, right? Why are these guys not living past 30? Lions and tigers and bears, oh my! So it's all the factors that have to be taken into account. So when you're looking at blood sugar, I have blood sugar right there at the base of my pyramid with digestion. Sometimes people need to address the blood sugar to get their digestion working. Sometimes they need to address the digestion to get the blood sugar working. The sweet spot diet that we've put together that you get taught in insulin resistance program really helps with the digestion. It doesn't help with the fine-tuning the digestion with specific severe leaky gut or dysbiosis, but it does work with it. But we do have a digestion program. And so some people take digestion first and then blood sugar, and some people take blood sugar first and then digestion. When we lay it out in our full NEPT program, we do digestion and then we do blood sugar. We do digestion first. And it's all going to be unique to that person. You're going to find the root cause and you're going to help them fix it. So we want to map the postprandial glucose. And this is, you know, all the stuff you already know about. Just a reminder, waist to hip ratio, all the blood tests, the glucose, the A1C, the insulin, the antibodies, the HDL triglycerides, HDL triglyceride ratio. All of these things are important, and the SNPs sit on top of it. And there's your reminder of your blood glucose lab testing. You want these things to be normal, and these are good ways to check to see if things are working. So one last slide, which is reference sites for some really good information about genes, and you can generally put in a search for any of these. This first one is called Genetics Home Reference, and it's got some good stuff. It's not complete, doesn't have every single gene that you may want to be looking up. SNPedia, they have a lot of this. Gene cards, they have a lot, and there may be others. There's always more and more that are coming out. And they're basically databases of the genes. They give you little information about it. And using Google, good old Google, to search for, and I'd say Google Scholar, you're going to get the more scholarly articles from National Library of Medicine. And a lot of these studies that I gave you references for were from the National Library of Medicine. So government-sponsored, you know, published journals, scholarly articles, hard to read because if you don't know all the chemistry, but, you know, some you get the gist and you can get some information about it. So I hope this was super helpful. I'm going to go ahead and stop the video recording so we have a clean video recording. And then I'm going to just open up for questions.